shooting out sparks over 38 states, the Canadian Plains, and the tequila fields of Mexico.
A program most deserving of a grand introduction.
The Nocturnal Journal.
The Talk of the Town. WGN Radio 720.
With your guide, Dave Hoekstra.
Welcome to the Nocturnal Journal tonight on WGN. We've got a very, very compelling show, I would say, in the second half hour. We've got Toby Rhodes and his band, and we're going to talk a little bit on the Allman Brothers. And we're going to, a little bit later, we're going to pay tribute to Jimmy LaFave. Dan Long, how's those Neil Diamond tickets coming for tomorrow night?
You tell me. Don't you have a lady friend you want to take?
Well, you know, I never use the show for social purposes, but yeah, although I was looking at the set list, it's not a very good set list for Neil. He's not doing a lot of the old stuff, you know? I mean, like Shiloh and Solitary Man, and he's not doing a lot of that. He's doing Cherry Cherry and I'm a Believer, but I think I'm going to take a pass. So our first guest is our dear friend. We've worked on a couple projects together. Actually, a lot of projects together. Jamie Caesar, longtime Chicago producer. We got something coming up on June 1st. Jamie, you're the first guest I think we've had on Nocturnal Journal to bicycle down to see us.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's exciting. Yeah. I took a long trip here, 12 miles to get here.
How long did it take?
In fits and spurts, about an hour.
We kind of live in the same neighborhood.
Yeah.
Like near north and stuff. So we've got an event coming up June 1st at Fitzgerald's. We're going to kind of screen a little bit of the documentary we've been working on about Springfield, Missouri. But before we get into the details of that, I'm going to ask you some questions that I don't even know. I've known you forever, but you've been in television production and television here for a very, very long time in Chicago.
That would be my whole career.
Yeah.
And I started at Channel 11, and I was on staff for 17 years, and I've freelanced there ever since.
And I didn't know until you sent us this got the information for our event. 9 Emmy Awards?
10.
10 Emmy Awards. That's amazing.
Well, that and 25 cents will get you a cup of coffee and nothing else.
And one thing I don't know is how'd you get into television?
Well, I was a huge fan of television and the Johnny Carson show and watching the backstage machinations with Freddie DeCordova. And I loved An American Family, the documentary, when that came out. And, of course, my favorite show on television, The Mary Tyler Moore Show. So I had to be an associate producer.
And how'd you break in? Where'd you grow up?
Grew up in Glenview.
Grew up in Glenview.
And then I went to Michigan State University.
I know that, yeah.
Go Green. And then I got an internship at Channel 2 during college. And met a couple people, and they met people, and found out about a gig at Channel 11, and I got the job.
And you talk about how you've seen
And I can just tell you one really good story. When I got my interview at Channel 11 the first day, they gave me a tour of the studios, and in Studio A, rehearsing for a soundstage, was Ella Fitzgerald, Count Basie, and Joe Pass. And when I went in there and saw that, I thought, I could work here.
Yeah.
It would be a great place. So I've worked on several soundstage shows, programs, and Center Stage, which was sort of in between, which is, I think, when I met you.
And you said, I think it's really interesting, you said you've seen the face of television change. In your own words, I mean, how has it changed as it affects you?
Well, as it affects me, the technology has changed so much. Where when I started, a camera with a lens was maybe $20,000, and now people are doing television on iPhones. So everything has changed. You know, one person can do everything as opposed to a three-person crew. And so you have to now know, rather than be focused on one thing and know it very well, like producing, you have to be able to do everything.
Oh, that's interesting. And what does that mean for the viewer? How has that time changed for the viewer over the years?
Well, it's changed in terms of the way they watch television. So now they watch it on their phone or their computer or their Roku or whatever it is. So It's changed considerably.
Are you worried about everybody talks about cutting the cord and going and just watching stuff on their iPad and stuff like that? Is that a trend?
I mean, well, I want to do it too. I'm trying to do it, but it's what it has also given is more opportunity to produce content. And so now, instead of just having, when I started, five channels, it's cable. They still need content, whether you've cut the cord or not, and the internet and Netflix and Amazon and every single website needs content. So, and actually, if you can get in there and just keep producing stuff, you're going to be okay.
Some of the things listeners would know that you were involved with. The one thing maybe one of the first big projects I associate with you is the Bill Veeck stuff.
Right.
Tell us about the Bill Veeck connection.
Okay, well, I worked on a sports show, if you can believe it, for a year called Time Out, and Bill Veeck.
And who all was on Time Out? Was that the panel?
Was that
Shulian and all that?
That was John Shulian, Kenny McReynolds, Fran Spielman, and John Mangold. Mm-hmm. And Bill Veeck had a little segment at the end of the show at a bar, and my job on that show, among other things, was to drive him home, which was oh so sweet. I mean, he would tell me some great stories, like, "Oh, there's the Shoreland Hotel. That's where Edward R. Murrow interviewed Mary Frances and I." And he would just tell great stories, and I got to know him and Mary Frances. I read his biography, Veeck Is in Wreck.
One of the best baseball books ever.
And, great stories, too. Yeah. And so I wrote them a letter, and I said, you know, I'd like to produce a documentary on you. And he called me back, Mary Frances on one line, he on the other line. And, you know, they were like, okay, we think you can do it. We think you can handle it. And they were just wonderful.
So, and you keep in touch with Mary Frances, I know that.
I do, and she's 96 now.
Isn't that great?
And she is fantastic, and it's sharp as ever, and always has great baseball stories.
Yeah, we're all friends of the Veeck family here. Mike's been on the show several times, great family. Lately, how much can you talk about the Art Paul documentary? Tell us about it. I think that's a fascinating subject. Tell everybody who Art Paul is.
So I'm currently working on a documentary on Art Paul, and for those of you who don't know his name, probably know what he's known for. He was the founding art director of Playboy magazine and the creator of the Playboy logo. But he is so much more than that. And he is an artist, and he nurtured all this talent from Chicago, like Ed Paschke, Roger Brown, Roy Schneckenberg, Carl Wersum, all this talent who worked for Playboy, producing art. And what he did, he's known for blurring the lines between illustration and art. He had these fine artists producing illustration for him, and he was able to nurture them and give them salaries, they were freelance, but money for their work so that they could work on their fine art. And Paschke said that he couldn't have been a painter without that income coming in.
And when will that be out?
Hopefully in July.
And that's for?
Well, we're hoping Channel 11, Netflix, Amazon, you know, the way of the independent producer.
It's kind of what we're doing with our Springfield
documentary.
It's
kind of exactly what we're doing with our documentary.
And how long, this again ties into what you and I have been working on, along with Brent and Tom and Renee. How long have you been working on the Art Paul documentary?
4 years.
4 years.
Yeah.
And you always tell me you really have to be patient with these things.
Yes.
These don't happen.
Yes.
I come from print where everything's kind of immediate, and these documentaries take time.
Right. They take time either because you need the story needs to play out, or they take time because you need to raise the money, and that takes time. And that actually happened where we had to raise money, so we did a little here and there. Then we had to we started shooting, and then we had to wait until we got more money, and that's kind of how it happens, unfortunately.
Is there a time you know when you're done?
when you give it to the editor.
we're gonna
you're
take,
never done, Dave, as you know, you're never done.
We're going to take a break here for some spots, and we're going to come back and talk about the Springfield Jamboree after this on WGN.
Thursday night, June 1st.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN. That's Abby Waterworth, who will be at a Springfield Jamboree on Thursday night, June 1st at Fitzgerald. We're importing her from Springfield. Jamie, you've seen her. Quite a singer. 20 years old.
And she's fabulous. She really knocked my socks off when I heard her for the first time in Springfield. She's young. She has a lot of energy. She's got a great voice. And she's going places like Chicago.
Yeah. That's right. And, I mean, what she's done is she studies history down there. And she, this record she just came out with where Sugar Shack is from, I was telling the folks in the green room that it's all like music that came out of Springfield that people don't realize came out of Springfield, Missouri. The Letter, but you know, by Wayne Carson, Ronnie Self, who wrote I'm Sorry for Brenda Lee, and so much more. Michael McCall, are you on the line from the Country Music Hall of Fame?
Hi there. Hey, I'm here. Good to talk to you, man.
Michael McCall, staff editor, writer, and curator at the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum since 2006. Thanks for joining us. Jamie, our co-producer for this little thing, is with us tonight. But you're in our doc, and in your own words, you did such a great job for us describing about the importance of Springfield then and now. I mean, the Ozark Jubilee and then what happened recently. So can you pick up on that?
Right. Yeah, you know, the history of the Ozark Jubilee is in 19, you know, it started as a radio show on ABC Radio in 1950s when really country music was right at the brink of before rock and roll started. Country music was at the height of sort of national popularity. And it was a big show, you know, and then Springfield was as big as, you know, the Grand Ole Opry, you know, as shows that were in, you know, other shows in Chicago or Dallas or Atlanta, all these big radio shows, but Springfield was just as big as all of them. And it ended up being that, you know, it was the first national TV show in 1955. I think January 1955 was the first and still longest running network TV show on country music. So it's Johnny Cash or Patsy Cline or Farron Young, and it created stars like Brenda Lee and Porter Wagoner. It's incredibly important to the history of country music.
What do you, for both Jamie and you, Michael, how does, and this is, I keep talking about this all the time, I know Jamie's sick of it, but about, you know, sense of place and regionalism and the way the environment informs the music. I mean, we've been working on this 2.5-3 years, and I always use Les Blank's work as a little bit of a reference. Then the Muscle Shoals documentary came out. But, I mean, here's Springfield, so isolated and in the hills and religion and all this stuff going around there. How does that, in your experience, Michael, just in different pockets across America, how does that inform music?
Well, you know, I think sometimes people think of all music coming out of Nashville or Los Angeles or New York or Chicago or Detroit. And there are these, you know, great little pockets like how important Muscle Shoals was or Bakersfield, California, you know, and what it, how important that was to country music, you know, Macon, Georgia and blues rock and Southern rock. You know, Wheeling, West Virginia was a huge place, which is as small as it can be, you know, and you'd have more people show up for a radio show and live performances there than lived in the town, you know, and Springfield had a little bit of that. It's sort of a small, you know, it's big for its region, but it's a small town compared to big cities. And it had just, they had a studio, they had a radio show, they had a man who was, Cy Simon, who sort of had his vision for creating country music and bringing together shows. And it just ended up having, you know, being really important to the history of American music.
Jamie, in your experience, and maybe even what we're working on, I don't know the answer to this really, but how does it affect you as a producer and looking at stuff? I mean, when you maybe move away from just the talking heads to, I mean, I am proud of the work that our friend Tom Volodik put in this with some of the evocative scenes he got of the landscape in Springfield, the lakes, the rivers. How does that alter the way you look at things?
Well, I think that most of the shows that I've worked on are about Chicagoans. I think it's the character. There's a type of person that comes out of Chicago with the Chicago accent, with the neighborhoods, with the neighborhood bars, the parishes, you know, the different neighborhoods, all this kind of thing meshes together to create an environment and a story. And in every single person that I've followed and produced a documentary about, They all talk about the neighborhoods. They all talk about the food. They all talk about where they hang out, and that all becomes this who they are and what the city's about.
Great. I mean, that's the thing, Michael. I mean, the times we're living in right now, and I was talking to Peter Grelnick a couple of weeks ago about what we're doing. The times we're living in right now, I don't want to load up the question, but it really is important to understand community and what community means.
Right. I mean, regional music, and as Jamie was saying, I think that idea of what a place is, you know, the Muscle Shoals documentary did a great job of sort of setting the idea of this swampy, southern, you know, humid area, and how, you know, if somebody like Aretha Franklin or Wilson Pickett comes down there, it was, you know, they related with this area, you know, and that area sort of seeps into the sound. And in the same way, regional food and, you know, landscape all plays into that. And Springfield was part of that. You know, you're in the Ozark Mountains. You have this, you know, beautiful area. It's full of lakes, but it's also, you know, a bit isolated.
Right.
And so it has its own. And when you have somebody like Lou Whitney or Ozark Mountain Daredevils, some people who sort of came up in that area, you know, it affects their sound because it's different than anything else.
Robbie Felks, he tells us in the documentary that isolationism really kind of leads to a creative muse, you know what I mean? You're not bothered by stuff
right.
all the time when you're in a place
right.
like Springfield.
And then you have a little bit more freedom. You have, I think when you go to a corporate, you know, studio that's run by a big studio, by a big record label, there's a different kind of pressure, you know, and where if you're, you know, down in Alabama, or you're down in Texas, or you're down in Florida, or you're down in Missouri, you know, or even in Chicago, you have a little bit of freedom to find your own sound without the influence of trying to sound like somebody else.
Okay, we got a break for David Jennings in the news. Now, Michael, you're going to hang on because we're going to talk. I'm going to continue the regionalism
sure.
thing into a little bit of Jimmy LaFave. Do you want to hang around, Jamie? Or are you in a hurry?
Only biking my night away.
So. Okay. All right, we're going to be back and continue this discussion on WGN's Nocturnal Journal.